Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Joe Tooman, Professor of Political and Legal Communications at San Francisco State University, and also a political analyst for CBS 5 News, Television and Radio here in San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Margaret Hoover, Fox News contributor, member of the Board of Overseers at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, a very fine think tank, by the way, and also author of the new book, American Individualism, How a New Generation of Conservatives Can Save the Republican Party. I should mention about Margaret, by the way, she's also someone who's worked in political campaigns, worked as a staffer in the White House before, and is someone who has a very unique perspective on conservatism, the history of conservatism. I want to introduce her without mentioning her great-grandfather, but it's going to come up because I think you should judge her on her own merits and not necessarily on who she's related to. But it's going to come up because I think it informs her perspective on what conservatism has become in this country and how it's different from perhaps what her great-grandfather envisioned a great deal of time ago. And by the way, by her great-grandfather, I'm talking about Herbert, not J. Edgar. So we're all clear about this. Obviously enough. I think you're going to find her, by the way, a very warm and charming speaker tonight, and I hope you'll extend a special San Francisco welcome to her. Please welcome with me now Margaret Hoover.
Thank you very much for having me. It is a delight to be here. I used to come here almost every quarter. My grandmother passed away about a year and a half ago, but she lived till she was 98 and a half, 6 months, 6 weeks before my wedding, which was here in Palo Alto, actually at Stanford Church. And I have a very, very fond place in my heart for this part of the country. I think it's maybe part of my heritage. But the subtitle of my book, moving right along, is How a New Generation of Conservatives Can Save the Republican Party. Now, I have been accused by my father, first and foremost, of over-dramatizing the situation about the Republican Party. Is this alarmist, is the question. And in the context of our current debates, I think many people would say, actually, the Republican Party is on the uptick. What on earth could you possibly mean? And actually, I don't think this is over-dramatization. I'm actually quite serious about the dilemma the Republican Party is in, because when you look at the demographic data, and when you look at the 30 and under generation, they are not Republicans, and this book is about a risk, because I think that the Republican Party is at risk of losing a rising generation of Americans to Democratic and independent voter rolls for the rest of their lives. I write about the millennials. The millennials are 30 and under. They're so-called because they're the first generation to come of age in the new millennium. They were born at the beginning of the Reagan era through the end of the Clinton presidency. They are the largest generation in American history. There are 17 million more millennials than there are baby boomers, 27 more millennials than there are Gen Xers. Also, just FYI, it should come as no surprise. They made the difference in Barack Obama's election, and they are not Republican. In 2008, 50 million of them were eligible to vote, and half of them turned out to the polls. They represented 18% of the electorate. In raw votes, Barack Obama won the election by 10 million votes, and in the 30 and under cohort, he won by 8 million votes. Just to give you a sense of what that means in every age group. So why is this urgent? This is urgent because political identity and partisan identity takes on the characteristics of cement over time. It starts soft and then it solidifies. So after three presidential election cycles, partisan identity tends to solidify. They voted for John Kerry in 04. They voted for Barack Obama in 08. Republicans, if we're serious, have 16 months to make inroads with this generation, or we risk losing them. Now, to me, it will come as no surprise that I find this deeply troubling. But the reason isn't just because I'm a Republican. I actually think that the conservative movement and the Republican Party have put forth ideas that I think are most relevant to this generation and to the problems in our society and our government that they are most concerned about and that most affect their lives. And I think it's up to the Republican Party, and this is what I've tried to do in the book, is to characterize who these young people are, what makes them tick, so that we can reach out to them and connect to them and hopefully win their loyalty. Now, the title of my book is inspired by my great-grandfather. Yes, I'm going to mention him only because I'm actually quite proud of this heritage, and he has informed my perspectives about the party and the conservative movement. He wrote a book in 1922 called American Individualism. And I believe he captures in very surprising ways some of the ethos of this next generation. And I'm going to talk about that for a minute. But first, give you a little bit more background and texture on how I arrived at writing this book. So as long as I can remember, I've been a Republican. I've always, because of my great-grandfather, been a student of his life and legacy, though not many people are. I never knew him. I was born 13 years after he passed away. But my upbringing was informed of stories about him and stories in the family. I think there's sort of a weird quirk of growing up in a presidential family and hearing stories like my father being taught by General MacArthur how to make a flank with his toy soldiers. General MacArthur lived upstairs from my great-grandfather at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. I mean, stories like David Eisenhower tells, you know, David Eisenhower, who Camp David is named after, just because his grandfather was looking for a name for his new presidential retreat. I mean, these are just stories that are sort of quirks of being from a presidential family. And despite this heritage, I really shied away from participating in politics when I was growing up. I didn't intern for a local representative. I didn't pursue jobs in politics. I didn't decide to major in political science. Instead, I studied Spanish language literature. I studied Mandarin Chinese. I studied abroad in Bolivia and in Mexico and in China. And when I graduated from college, I moved to Taipei, Taiwan, where I got my first job as a research assistant and editor in a Taiwanese law firm. And everything really changed for me the first day I arrived there, which was September 11th, 2001. And on that day and in the weeks that followed, I realized that I wanted nothing more to be back in the United States, where really the deepest expression of patriotism was stirring in my country something that I had never seen before, the likes that none of us had really ever seen before. And as we all stayed up throughout the days and nights watching television glued to it, I was so moved, as all Americans were, by the words of George W. Bush and the spirit and leadership of Rudy Giuliani. And everyone was so openly patriotic, including youth. And I just wanted to be part of that. I wanted to participate in the functioning of our democracy. And I thought it would be an incredible honor to work for George W. Bush. So I shored up a year in Taiwan, returned to the United States, found my way to Washington by volunteering on a Senate race in my home state of Colorado. I landed a job in the House of Representatives for actually a member of Congress who was brand new from Miami because he was looking for somebody who spoke Spanish in his Washington office. So that Spanish paid off. And then had the good luck of getting a job on President Bush's reelection campaign in 2003 and then receiving a White House appointment in 2004. And then 2 years later, I had the chance to move to New York to work for Rudy Giuliani when he was thinking about running for president. Now, during the course of the Bush presidency, I sensed a mounting anger amongst my friends and my age group against George W. Bush. And in the 2004 campaign and during my tenure at the White House, while I remained, and I remained involved in politics through 2008 as a commentator, and all of the polling confirmed this observation that during the Bush presidency, Republicans really lost the youth vote. I'm used, by the way, I'm completely comfortable with being in the minority of my peers, in the minority in terms of politics amongst my peers. In fact, I would argue that as a descendant of Herbert Hoover, I'm actually cut out for it. When you grow up being related to the most vilified president in 20th century history, you really learn to not only develop a thick skin, but also to not just discount the contemporary narrative or the mainstream narrative, but to really reflect on it and begin to think independently about it. And, you know, Herbert Hoover has been the whipping boy for economic hard times throughout my life. And I would also mention that it's actually gotten worse in my lifetime, not better. I grew up being very used to and accustomed to Democrats pulling out Herbert Hoover and whipping on him. But Republicans are doing it now, which is an incredible shift. I mean, John McCain, for the first time in 2008, mentioned Herbert Hoover in a political debate against Barack Obama. Barack Obama, by the way, didn't even mention Hoover. And now Mitt Romney is running against Herbert. What did he say? Obama's Hoovervilles. Is Romney's, one of Romney's new shticks. And even Rush Limbaugh, who was a bit of a political hero for me in my teenage years, is saying Barack Hoover Obama is one of, was Limbaugh's new riffs. So look, I mean, this, needless to say, but I feel like I can't mention the criticisms of Hoover without reminding people that Herbert Hoover is somebody who his contemporaries called the master of emergencies, a great humanitarian. He was the pioneer of the modern NGO. His biographers have him as having saved through famine relief close to a billion people in his lifetime. Not to mention the fact that he, in 1927, marshaled enormous federal resources to save 1.5 million displaced Americans from the Mississippi River flood, all paid for by private funds. So this was an incredible human being, pioneered many, many things in his lifetime, authored over 30 books, seven of which, by the way, were between the ages of 85 and 90. And by the way, one of those books is going to be coming out in this September. It was completely finished at his death, and the plan was at his death for it to be published, and it wasn't. So it is an 800-page tome that has barely been edited. An editor actually added 125-page introduction. So an incredible human being, the likes of which I think we have not before or after seen in the presidency. And so sorry for my riff on Herbert Hoover. Sometimes I can't help myself because I think he hasn't gotten a fair shake. Back to millennials. Some say, and I include Rush Limbaugh in this, that it's not worth going after youth. They will eventually get there. If you're not, you know, it's the Churchillian. If they're not liberal when they're 20, they don't have a heart. If they're not conservative by the time they're 40, they don't have a brain. If this were true, we'd be off the hook. But Ronald Reagan is our best icon in this sense, and Ronald Reagan brought an entire generation into the Republican Party. This was the Reagan Revolution. He won the youth vote in 1984 by 20 points. So it's just simply not true that Republicans can't win the youth vote or have never won the youth vote. And even the first millennials who were eligible to vote in 2000 split their ticket evenly between George Bush and Al Gore. Now, it's worth mentioning that youth's political views are formed by the failures they know. They don't have, in politics, the failures in politics they know. So they don't have huge amounts of experience, and they are often reacting negatively to the failures they come to know and subscribing to something else. This is one explanation for why they rallied to Ronald Reagan in 1980. They were rejecting the failures of the Carter administration. And politics is perception, and the perceived failures. I was part of the Bush administration. I was proud to work for George W. Bush, and I defend him through her. I mean, I really defend him because I understand where he was coming from, but I also understand why he lost millennials. And they believed what John Kerry said, that the Iraq war was the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. And they believed that he failed them in hurricane. He failed, and the federal government failed in Hurricane Katrina, though I worked in the White House during Hurricane Katrina. I was one of the people that worked directly with the mayors in the Gulf Coast. And I'm happy to take that up in Q&A, but politics is perception. And the ethics scandals in the House of Representatives in 2006, all of these things really contributed to a rift of youth from the Republican Party and towards what became Obama mania. And I think that Barack Obama really captured the ethos of this generation by talking about, one, a desire to rise above partisanship, an appeal to service, and the resolve to make government work again. And those are things that I think really crystallize and capture the millennial generation. And I think areas where we can actually win them back. Now, not to add insult to injury, but just one other thing. The Republican Party, if we were growing in other areas, maybe we could afford to lose millennials. But Gallup did this very damning study. And between 2001 and 2009, Republican identification shrunk in 25 of 26 areas. The only area where we didn't shrink was in weekly churchgoers. And we didn't grow either. We stayed the same. So that makes this even more imperative. And the good part is we actually have an opportunity, because these things that Obama characterized in his election, there is pretty strong evidence that they've been disappointed. I was heartened. Joe and I were talking beforehand, and we can get to this in Q&A. He thinks I've characterized millennials very well in my book, which I'm very grateful, since he teaches them and deals with them in and out every day. And there are signs that they have been disappointed. They didn't turn out in the 2010 election nearly in the numbers that they turned out in the previous off-year election cycle in 2006. They're 37% unemployed. And his job approval rating is down 18 percentage points since January of 2009. Now, it's still very high, but down 18 points is a significant chunk. So what I've tried to do in the book is characterize the sensibilities of the generation so that we can communicate to them. And I've taken issues where I think the Republican Party and the conservative movement are already basically aligned with the sensibilities of this generation, and I've outlined how we need to connect the dots. But there are a couple of issues where we're already there. Like where we are, where they are, we just need to make the case. There are other issues where it's not so obvious, but I think there's a strong case to be made, like immigration reform, American exceptionalism, Islamist supremacy, which was formerly known as the War on Terror and is now the Overseas Contingency Operation. What I argue is that American individualism, as embodied by Herbert Hoover, is actually a framework for how we can connect to the next generation. So, who are the millennials? I'm going to make it easy. I'm just going to go to three things that we should know about them, and that are, when I say we, I'm speaking as a Republican, of course. And these are things that are counterintuitive, that Republicans or conservatives may not know and sort of may be surprised about, but if they're going to, and we're going to communicate to them, these are things we ought to consider. First, they have a positive view of government. They don't think government is evil. They think government should work and can work. Consider the following question. Just consider how you would answer this. Agree or disagree. When something is run by the government, it is usually managed inefficiently and wastefully. Consider how you would answer that. 42% of millennials agree. Said differently, 58% of millennials think that the government is really good at running things. That means that Reagan's government is the problem line simply isn't going to work. Incidentally, invoking Reagan generally isn't going to work either. The oldest millennials were 8 years old when he left office. So that visceral reaction that people who saw the Reagan Revolution, were part of the Reagan Revolution, get when we invoke Reagan isn't going to work for this generation. Secondly, when it comes to social issues, millennials are the least traditional generation in America. They adhere least to traditional family structure. They have been raised with more single-parent households. They are the least religious generation. Only a quarter of them identify with organized religion, although 67% of them say that they pray every day and they consider themselves very spiritual. And they are the only generation where a majority believes in same-sex marriage. They just couldn't be bothered at all by sexual orientation as an issue or something that makes, it just doesn't even faze them. And that is an important generational difference. Also, the culture wars of the 90s with women's rights and abortion rights is not a third rail in politics for them. it just isn't going to rally them to the polls one way or the other. And we can talk about this more in the Q&A. But they've basically arrived in organic consensus about abortion. They believe it's morally wrong, but they don't believe it should be illegal. Third, their politics are pragmatic, not ideological. So the bulk of them consider them, so 40% of them call themselves moderate, only 29% liberal, 28% conservative. But they pride themselves on being pragmatic. And I think this is why Barack Obama's rhetoric really appealed to them, right? Barack Obama was about not red states, not blue states, but the United States of America. He was about a government that worked. And they just don't adhere to strict, rigid ideology. In fact, they turn off talking points. If you want to lose them, you know, MSNBC's doing points or some of the, you know, the great right wingers on Fox also tune them out, unfortunately. So I think given these three things, the issue for Republicans is how we communicate with them in a way that is going to get traction. And I think for the conservative movement and the Republican Party, the way forward for 2012 is to focus on social issues, is to focus rather not on social issues, on economic issues and fiscal issues. They are 37% unemployed or underemployed. I just had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last Friday, making the case that while President Obama is still personally quite popular, therefore indemnifying him personally isn't going to work. We can make the case for a pro-growth economic agenda and describe what that means, and then we have some real traction. They're not working. They're open to this idea. But in these debates about debt and deficits, we should be talking in terms of generational theft, because the spending that is going on is nothing more than every dollar the government has spent is a dollar that you, me, and my peers and my younger siblings, we're going to have to pay back with interest. And it is nothing more than generational theft. No one my age thinks we're going to get Social Security or Medicare. And the Republicans, I would argue, are the ones who have represented the real hope and change and not Washington politics as usual, because we have not punted. We are the Republicans are the ones who have taken the future, the fiscal future of the next generation seriously by offering real alternatives and I think steering the ship, turning the ship around in Washington in the last 12 months. I mentioned earlier there are a couple of other issues where we're already aligned with them. We just need to make the case. And one of these other issues is education reform. The millennial generation, they're the most diverse generation in American history, 40% non-white, 20% have an immigrant parent, at least one immigrant parent. The promise of America and the promise of American individualism is that everyone, and we decided this a long time ago, that everyone will have an equal opportunity to rise above the circumstance of their birth based on their skills and their talents. And part of that, we decided a long time ago, is having a fair shake at a good education. And the fact that 30% of millennials are dropping out of high school, and the overwhelming majority of them are Black and Hispanic, 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, that our school system is still effectively segregated into poor zip codes and rich zip codes, offends the sensibilities of this generation, and I think has motivated them to service, especially in the form of Teach for America and the KIPP schools and the alternative education movement. And I think especially with movies like Waiting for Superman that have really galvanized public opinion, but especially millennials, and demonstrated what the problems are, the systemic problems in the education system, they are beginning to see that the Democratic Party simply can't fix it because their hands are tied by the unions. And this isn't a partisan statement. This isn't a beating up on union statement. This is just the fact. The NEA teachers unions donated $40 million to Democratic candidates in 2010. The two teachers unions were 10% of the DNC delegates in 2008. It's just a fact that the real reforms in education across the country are happening in states where Republican governors and Republican legislatures are able to take on the systemic problems which are really held in place by the teachers unions. So this is an area where I think we just need to connect the dots. And another area that always ticks high on their on the Richter scale in terms of an issue they care about is the environment. And I talk about a conservative environmentalism and forging a platform that is consistent with our history. The Republican Party has you know, Teddy Roosevelt really began the environmental movement in this country, and he was a Republican. We have a strong legacy of environmentalism in this country. And what I argue is there is no reason why we can't have a pro-market conservative environmentalism. And I also incidentally think that we can admit that the Earth's climate is changing while still admitting that global climate change or climate science is still inexact. And there was a cover of Newsweek in 1975 that showed the Earth freezing over because they believed that the Earth was getting colder. I mean, science is inexact, but we don't need to be global climate change heretics, is what I would say. And I think we can put forth a pro-market conservative environmentalism that doesn't embrace the left-wing solutions that would levy enormous taxes on the middle class, that would dampen innovation for energy reform, and that, frankly, I mean, with the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill, which Republicans labeled cap-and-tax, you know, this would have dramatically raised energy costs in the United States, levied an enormous tax on the middle class, while analysts suggest that it would have only reduced global temperatures by 0.1 degrees over 100 years, and that's only if you don't take into account the fact that China and India continue to grow. So there's, I think we can argue that while government has an important role to play when it comes to protecting the environment, it cannot and should not be trusted to deliver a low-carbon, energy-independent future. I think this comes from individuals, and this comes from individuals working together driven by the realities of the market. The book is divided on the back end in terms of issue areas and chapters. I also talk about a new Republican feminism. You know, the Republican Party has a new sort of onslaught of female leadership starting in 2010. We have 3 new Republican governors. We have a slew of new elected women in Congress who represent a diversity of life choices in terms of their careers and the paths they've taken with their families. And then I also talk about social issues in the book, and I'm happy to discuss this more in the Q&A. Back to American individualism. When I began to think about how to connect millennials to the Republican Party, I realized that Herbert Hoover embodied much of the ethos of the millennial generation 80 years before the first of them were born. Now, this may sound far-fetched, but consider that he was a technologist. He pioneered and regulated radio waves so that radio could be a thriving commercial industry in this country. He was the first individual, not president, not cabinet member, he was the first individual ever to appear on television. He, in his mining career, developed several mining technologies, and which was, at the time, a cutting-edge career that he actually learned in the heart of the Silicon Valley at Stanford University. He was in the pioneer class there. He was a globalist. This generation, the millennials, are more connected internationally and they are more globally oriented than any generation before them. But Herbert Hoover, before he was president, before he even returned to the United States in Woodrow Wilson's cabinet, had circumnavigated the globe 5 times before the advent of aviation, had worked on 4 continents, had visited 6. He was truly the most global president before he was president that the country has ever seen. And I would actually argue maybe even after, I'd have to think about George H.W. Bush. I hadn't thought about that actually before I just said that. Also dedicated to public service. He was the great humanitarian. This generation, 83% of them have volunteered at least once in the last year. They value service, not political service, but public service. And he believed that government could work. He believed that government could be part of the solution. And this was really embodied from his years as Commerce Secretary, where he believed that government could be an umpire. It could not get in the way of business, but help make business and industry more efficient. So in 1922, and I borrowed the title from Herbert Hoover, he wrote this book called American Individualism. And it was fun. I was on Joe Scarborough's show the other day. The first thing he said is, I'm going to call your great-grandfather and tell him you stole the title of his book. And I was delighted because he's the only person in the media who was able to pick up on it and realize that I was directly drawing on the themes from my great-grandfather. And this, he had been living in Europe during the rise of Germany. He had also been in China's Boxer Rebellion. He was one of the last 200 foreigners to escape China. He escaped in a German mail boat with his wife, Lou, my great-grandmother, who was a remarkable woman, by the way, on her own, and I reference in the New Republican Feminism chapter. Actually, I talk about her a lot. The Bolsheviks had destroyed his ceramics factories in Russia. He had helped organize food relief for Russia, despite the fact that he couldn't stand Bolshevik politics. And he had seen the rise of a belligerent Germany. And because of all these things, he wanted to try to inoculate the United States from trying on the fad of isms that Europe was experimenting with at the time. Bolshevism, communism, socialism, cynicism. And at the time when he returned to the United States in Wilson's cabinet as the food administrator, he was worried that the United States was actually going to seriously attempt to implement maybe some of these ideologies. The Socialist Party of America was garnering up to 6% in presidential elections in the late teens. And so like the engineer that he was, he tried to reverse engineer America, and he tried to crystallize it down to its essence and figure out what made it work. And he decided that the ism in America was American individualism, that it was an individual-centered society that was tempered by the notion of equality of opportunity. And he knew that his story, because of that ideal, wasn't possible in any other country in the world. He was born a frontier orphan of no means. He began his career in manual labor, and he rose to the highest heights of leadership and earned wealth that any person could have imagined achieving. Towards the end of his, what ended up being a triumphant 1928 campaign, he gave a speech here in California called Rugged Individualism. And in this speech, he said America had a choice of two futures. America could choose between the American system of rugged individualism, this is a quote, or a European philosophy of diametrically opposed doctrines, doctrines of paternalism and state socialism. Every step of bureaucratizing of the business of our country poisons the very roots of liberalism, political equality, free speech, free assembly, free press, and equality of opportunity. This is not the road to more liberty, but the road to less. Now, I am struck by how relevant that is to our debates today. These are the themes and the riffs that we hear in the gatherings of the Tea Party. This is the theme and the risk we hear in the financial regulatory reform debate, that the over-bureaucratizing and regulation of the business saps individual initiative and saps economic opportunity. And I think if this is the choice in 2012, I think we can make the case that, and in a way that millennials will choose the system of Herbert Hoover's American individualism over the alternative. Now, I have a whole chapter called Conservative Tribalism in my book, because the conservative movement is like a very dynamic and diverse family sitting around a Thanksgiving table arguing when we're not united about, when we're not focused on what we agree on. And, you know, we all have heard of the terms neoconservative and paleoconservative and Western conservative and Goldwater conservative. And everybody tries to, if they call themselves conservative, characterize what kind of conservative they are so that you know that you're not that kind of conservative, but this kind of conservative. And, you know, 30 years ago, and again, I don't encourage invoking Reagan, but I encourage channeling Reagan. But for the purpose of this analogy, I'm going to invoke Reagan. And the reason Reagan was successful and is an icon in the conservative movement is because he was able to unify the conservative tribes. And we were able to all sing from the same song sheet for a period of time. And what we were aided by the coalition's unified interest in defeating communism. And he created a kind of fusionism that became the cohesive glue for all of the conservative tribes. And what I suggest is that if we focus on fiscal responsibility and growing the economy, and back to Bill Clinton's, it's the economy, stupid. You know, jobs, jobs, and jobs. I think we can provide a form of fusionism that can unite the various tribes of conservatism and attract a new generation to conservatism that also channels the essence of American individualism. So ultimately, my book was a culmination of a quest that I undertook in search of a Republican-rooted philosophy that it could appeal to a broad section of Americans, especially millennials. That the major source of my inspiration proved to be a book written nearly a century ago by my great-grandfather might be surprising. But I think millennials may also be surprised to discover fresh thinking and new ideas within the Republican Party. And in these sources, find the hope and the change that they've been waiting for. Thank you very much.
Margaret, you've been standing for a while. Would you like to sit and I'll pitch you the questions from here, or would you like to stay up there?
I'm fine standing. I'm worried about the technology. Technically we can do it with a microphone, I'd be fine sitting down, but I just don't want to take anyone out of their way.
You can have my microphone.
I'm good.
All right.
My heels aren't that tall.
All right. And for everybody in our live and our radio and television audience and the Internet, our thanks to Margaret Hoover, Fox News contributor and author of the new book, American Individualism, How a New Generation of Conservatives Can Save the Republican Party. It's now time for what you all came for our audience question period. And we have a lot of questions here, so I've tried to categorize them. I'll do my best to get everybody's, but we only have so much time. So let me begin this actually with a clarification question on behalf of the audience to allow you to sort of synthesize this down into a soundbite. Margaret, if you had to synthesize this down into a sentence, what do you mean by American individualism in a sentence? And in a sentence, why would a millennial care?
American individualism is the guiding principle for a new generation of Americans. It is, in essence, rugged individualism imbued with a community spirit.
So personal
Herbert
liberty?
Hoover, and yeah. The reason I relate to Herbert Hoover is, the reason this book is, Hoover believed not only was the American system, it worked because it was a system centered around the individual that prized the ideal of equality of opportunity. But part of what he writes about in his own book, American Individualism, is the spirit of America that has a responsibility for its citizenry, where there is a sense of purpose and belonging, and that he talks a lot about volunteerism. He has it's a 9,000 word piece about, and he has, almost 1,000 words dedicated to volunteerism and the voluntary spirit in America, that even though we're individual centered, we're not it's not sort of this selfish individualism. It's an individualism that's deeply imbued with a sense of responsibility for one another. And I think this appeals especially to the millennial generation.
I see. Okay, good. You answered that question. Let's start with the questions from the audience then. And you'd be surprised to know that we got 6, 7 questions about your great-grandfather. So there are
I love
a lot
those questions, though, because I care so much about correcting his legacy, or at least being part of an impetus to reevaluate not just his whole life, but also his presidency.
Okay. I'm going to actually read you all the questions. They're all variations on the same. It'll be real quick, and then you can answer how you wish, okay?
He's on my eyes.
One audience member, I try and enfranchise our audience here. One audience member wrote, "Unfortunately, George W. Bush's presidency was marked by a recession." This was kind of a negative one. Equal to the depression presided over by your great-grandfather. This occurrence is what lost the youth and others. Please comment. So there'll be that. Margaret Hoover, how would President Hoover have tackled the debt problem? It's a question. Someone else wrote, what would your great-grandfather have thought about the current state of the Republican Party?
I might need you to remind me of
it. It's okay. So debt problem, Republican Party. Another audience member wrote, your great-grandfather has been campaign fodder. And I don't think they mean fodder like the opposite of mutter, but they mean... That's a little humor there, sorry. For the opposition party, which means the Democrats, for 80 years, how do you think he would address our problem today of massive multi-trillion dollar debt run up by our government? It's sort of the same thing as debt, I think. And a final question about your grandfather. Would you please care to share a story or two about your great-grandfather that the public generally does not know about him? I think you actually did that in your speech, but if you want to as well. I'll throw all those up to you about grandfather.
So it's basically two.
Go ahead.
It's debt and deficit, state of the Republican Party, three. And is it equal, basically, to the situation that Barack Obama inherited?
Okay.
Is it analogous? So the first one, you know, we are just one basic measure of comparison to see whether this is equal or not. The unemployment rate today is 9.2% nationally. The unemployment rate during Herbert Hoover's presidency was 25%. So it's not an equal situation. We had not... I mean, this was the worst the Great Depression was the worst economic calamity in U.S. history and in global economic history. I just think it's incomparable. And what I would argue also is that Herbert Hoover's legacy as president is never, very, very rarely, judged within the context of the information that he had available to him at the time. The theories of modern macroeconomics have developed as a result of the Great Depression. The University of Chicago School of Economics developed, I mean, Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman began writing and publishing in the early 60s, 30 years after Herbert Hoover was out of the presidency. And FDR didn't have these theories available to him either. And one of the things that people conveniently forget is that the economy bottomed out and got worse in 1936 and 1937. So... I say, one, Herbert Hoover didn't have the tools in his toolkit in his presidency, sometimes I get on a slippery slope of defending Herbert Hoover. I think it's objectively they're not equal circumstances. Debt and deficits. This is a fascinating question. So Hoover is often criticized for how he handled the Depression, in terms of physically what he did. First of all, the criticism, the narrative in AP US history books is that he sat on his hands and did nothing. He really sat on the sidelines while the country fell apart. This is categorically untrue. The New York Times in 1930 and 1931 said that no president could have done more to handle the situation. I mean, he went into overdrive thinking about how to fix it. You know, it just turned out that we didn't know how to fix it. But he tried very hard. There were several things that he did. And one of the things that he desperately wanted to do was balance the budget. And this led to what fiscal conservatives criticize him for today, which was the sunsetting of the Coolidge tax cuts, which amounted to the largest tax hike in American history, which took marginal rates from the top rate from 25% to 63% in 1932. I mean, dope. I mean, this is something that fiscal conservatives think is absurd and ludicrous. But his argument was we had to balance the budget. We couldn't, at a time of economic hardship, finance the government on debt. And FDR actually ran against him in the campaign saying he wasn't balancing the budget. One of FDR's criticisms when he was governor, when Hoover was still president, was that he wasn't balancing the budget. Of course, the first thing FDR did was blow up the budgets and blow up the deficit as soon as he got in with the New Deal. And I think in that there is a clear parallel between what Barack Obama has done and what FDR did. State of the Republican Party. Here's an interesting thing I think that Hoover doesn't get credit for from conservatives. The conservative movement, the modern American conservative movement, really coalesced in reaction to the New Deal. It was really a movement that came about in the 50s, thanks to really Bill Buckley and National Review and a coalition of people who were all for various reasons, whether they were economic libertarians, traditionalist conservatives, or national anti-communist, really. This was the original three-legged stool of the conservative movement that was then joined by neoconservatives in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and evangelical Christians in the 80s with Ronald Reagan. I mean, this was the original conservative coalition. But the reality is, for the 30s and 40s, the most prominent American who was laying the foundation for what became the conservative movement was Herbert Hoover, and it was the clear argument against the New Deal and New Deal policies. Hoover wrote a book in 1934 called Challenge to Liberty, and it takes the ideas of American individualism. It's about four times longer, and he goes through systematically all the things that he believes the New Deal is doing to undermine what he believes is liberty in America and what it's about. And in that, we find, I believe, the intellectual framework for the conservative movement. And so Herbert Hoover, while he was not a conservative because he preceded the conservative movement, I think was philosophically aligned with the arguments of limited government and what became the crux of the argument for economic libertarianism. What else?
Okay. Let me shift us from your great-grandfather to another topic that you addressed today that I think was a focus of your discussion, and that's millennials. And there are a lot of questions for those. I don't know that I'll read all of them at once, but let me give you a couple of them to chew on. One of our audience members writes, Ms. Hoover, the millennial generation embraces service to the community, both nonprofit and government-funded. Republicans in Congress tried to close down something for national and community service, zero budget. How do millennials react to the Republican Party in light of this?
I'm sorry, can you just say the last part?
Okay. I guess the author in the audience, Corporation, I beg your pardon, I couldn't read it. Republicans in Congress recently tried to close down the Corporation for National and Community Service with a zero budget. How do millennials react to this in the Republican Party?
Well, millennials haven't been pulled on that specific, but I could make an argument for the conservative movement. We're for, at a time of fiscal distress, trying to shrink government across the board in many, many ways. And I think we can encourage volunteerism and community service without doing it through government. I think this is the purpose in our country of mediating institutions. Of churches and voluntary organizations and this network, this, as Herbert Hoover called it, a vast network of mediating institutions, community organizations that make the fabric of our culture. My view, that's how I would argue it to millennials, is that the government doesn't have to be the solution. We can be the solution.
Okay. Different question. And I think you spoke to part of this when you talked about moderating the position, if you forgive the expression moderating, on climate and on environmental issues.
Are you a stand-up comic on the side?
No, I'm just a professor, and scratch a professor, you find a frustrated comic. So here we go with a captive audience. Having grown up, this writer writes, with the Internet, Google, and the free flow of information, I think she wrote or he wrote, many of my generation, so this is a millennial, are off-put by the sometimes ludicrous and factually incorrect statements made by Republican politicians and commentators and their denial of the scientifically proven human contributions to global warming. How can the GOP gain the millennials' trust when its members often make us feel that they care more about gaining support for their positions through political gaming rather than using reason to find practical
okay.
and sensible solutions?
So first of all, I think if you take out the environmental aspect of that question, that the accusation can be equally levied at liberals as conservatives, right? You have ideologues on both sides who just, you know, lob ideological rhetoric at the other, and thank God for the Internet, an independent-minded person can do factcheck.org or Factiva or, you know, not Wikipedia, because, of course, we can all change the answers on Wikipedia. But sorry, that was a joke, but I'm not as good as you.
You're doing fine.
But in terms of climate science, I also would argue that there are plenty of Republicans who I don't think there are as many climate science deniers as some would say. I think that this is, I think there are a lot of narratives that are promulgated that cast Republicans in the form of crazies and wingnuts and, a little bit kooky or wacko. And I think, you know, these people who deny science, you know, the Republicans, I think is part of that narrative. And that's something that I think we need to address. And that's why I say, look, we can acknowledge that there's climate change without acknowledging and also acknowledge that it's an inexact science, but it's got to be okay in the Republican Party to acknowledge that there's climate change.
I think that's the answer that we're looking for. Let me throw in one more question on millennials from a different perspective. You were right, by the way. I teach them all the time. And what I found in my classes is that a lot of young people I talk to, like their older predecessors, get what they think about television informed by, not television, but politics rather, informed by watching television. The difference is that many young people get their political information from non-traditional television like Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert.
Which, so, by the way, is just as ideological.
Is ideological, but they're also they're comedians, not journalists, is the point.
Yeah.
So here's a question to you. Who on the conservative side, I mean, I don't think you'd put Bill O'Reilly or Glenn Beck into
this. We don't have funny people.
Well, that's my point. So if you're trying to attract millennials who like are probably drawn to these other sources because they're funny, right? And maybe that's a way of speaking to young people. I don't know that you treat this in your book, but just sort of riffing on this as someone who contributes to Fox, is there something to that about looking for a different way to talk to people and not take yourself so seriously, which I think is
totally
what Stewart and Colbert
absolutely
do.
I think conservatives take ourselves way too seriously sometimes. But also think about how is Jon Stewart, is the corollary to Jon Stewart not talk radio? Right? These are, if we're talking about entertainers who aren't in charge of the electorate, but who are making a political case to an audience who's basically like-minded, although I like watching Jon Stewart, he makes me laugh. These are ultimately entertainers. I agree. I would love to have more funny Republicans. I actually think the show at 3 a.m. on Fox News called Red Eye, I think those guys are some of the smartest guys on television. It's unfortunately it's at 3 a.m. and it's not winning any hearts and minds, but it's 8 p.m. in Hawaii. So.
That's a big audience.
12 p.m. here? 12 a.m. here. I'm sorry. I'm so East Coast centric. I apologize. I'm from the West. My father hates. I married a New Yorker. So I, yes. 12 a.m. Good to know. After the news.
Well, I'll just finish this point with you.
Okay.
I think going back to the question that you had from a young person before, this idea that there's a perception, maybe not fair, but a perception that some people in the Republican Party ignore science and advocate their position in the face of that, if you have a Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart who will sometimes also goof on a position and take absurdist positions, when a young person watches that, they know that they're not doing it because they're serious. They know they're doing that to be funny. If a Glenn Beck or if a Bill O'Reilly takes an absurd position, he's not being funny. The perception is that he's doing that and being serious. And that's, I think, from what the question came from the millennial listener in the audience said, creates the impression that it's an absurd position and you really believe it and we can't believe that position, so therefore we don't believe you. Is that a mistake with young people?
Yeah. In short, there's a clear disconnect and it can be probably, especially if like somebody like Limbaugh. I mean, I don't think O'Reilly fits in this category because O'Reilly's just not an ideologue. But I think somebody like Limbaugh, who, by the way, I grew up listening to. If you haven't listened to him, I mean, Limbaugh himself says you've got to listen to me.
He's from the Sacramento-Stockton area.
That's where he cut his teeth.
Yeah.
But he says if you don't listen to me for 3 weeks, you're not going to get it. You just like won't get me. You won't get my personality. You won't get my sense of humor. You won't get everything. And I think that's true. Like, if you listen to it, sorry for the like, I was just throwing in a millennial sensibility there. If you listen to him for a while, you understand when he's joking, when he's being egregious, when he is exaggerating to make a point. And same with Stewart. So I think this is what happens when you're an entertainer.
Okay. Different area of your book that you mentioned, and for those of you who haven't read it yet, this you'll find as you read her introduction, she talks about in her book having a Hoover goes to Washington moment of epiphany in the 2004 election when she sees a contradiction in the way that marriage equality is being portrayed in the Republican narrative of things and what she personally believes herself about how people should be treated the same. And I think she has that moment that all of us have worked in politics where there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance about it. How do I deal with this conflict internally? So there are some questions. She addresses this in the book, but there are some questions in the audience about the inclusion or inclusiveness or the lack of inclusiveness about gays and lesbians in our society and perhaps sparked by this issue about traditional marriage versus marriage equality. So some questions from the audience include, on the subject. What would you say to those of us who are in the Republican Party because of its platform on social issues, for example, right to life or traditional marriage? Is there room for us in the GOP, or has the Tea Party taken over? From one perspective. Another from someone else saying, do log cabin Republicans have a future, do you think, with the Republican Party the way it is now? And a final one to you. Would you relate the highlights of last week's conversation with Bill O'Reilly, especially his question to you about gay rights and choice, and your response to him regarding the role he's playing in the United States?
Somebody must have seen that segment. They got more mail on that segment than they had in several weeks. I accused Bill O'Reilly of splitting up the Republican Party on social issues. The conservative coalition, and this is where I am Reagan-esque, the conservative coalition cannot win without everyone at the table. And I think we need to focus on what unites us, not what divides us, which is why I urge us to focus on fiscal issues and not divide. You would not believe the number of radio stations that I've been on this week, and fortunately, in my book tour, all over the country, that with real social conservative hosts who said thank you for focusing on what unites us and not what divides us. And I think it is really important. Reagan had this: if you're 80% my ally, you are not 20% my enemy. Let's focus on what unites us, not what divides us. Not only is there room for social conservatives in the coalition, we need social conservatives in the coalition. And in many ways, I think social conservatism adds a very important component of traditionalism in our culture, which we need. Culture needs tradition. This is why... Yes. I would say on the issue of marriage, this is... a place where I think Dick Cheney, I am more Dick Cheney than I am Barack Obama. Dick Cheney is actually to the left of Barack Obama on this, right? Rick Perry just came out, who's probably going to shore up the evangelical base in the Republican primary and espouse the 10th Amendment, that what they did in New York just recently in terms of voting for same-sex marriage is up to them. This should be a states' rights issue. I think that's another way we can see this in the conservative coalition and in the Republican Party. But the reality is, with the 30 and under demographic, this is the only generation in American history where, as I said, sexual orientation is just not something that they think about as an issue. It should not be a divider. They are in favor of same-sex marriage. And I believe that the legacy of the Republican Party, which was founded in the tradition of abolition, that gave steam to the women's suffrage movement, we have individual liberty in our DNA. And I don't really like the language of marriage equality. I like the language of freedom to marry. I believe that this is consistent with our philosophy. This is consistent with our DNA and our tradition. And I believe that people of the same sex should be able to marry. And I think the argument for marriage is a very traditionalizing one. I think there are conservative arguments for marriage. If we want a world, if we want a society that is stable, that is formed by two people forming cohesive units and taking care of one another, I mean, this is what creates the fabric of society. Do we want people to take care of one another, or do we want the government to take care of them? I think we want to encourage stable units in society. We want to encourage marriage. We want more marriages, not less. And I think ultimately this grounds society in self-sufficiency so that people rely on each other economically and not the government.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, but I need to do a very quick update for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Margaret Hoover, Fox News contributor and author who is discussing the future of the Republican Party. Margaret, I just want to follow up, if I may, on the last answer you gave. There was a thread of something which I thought is kind of interesting. Are you suggesting that in a pitching or appealing to millennials, that maybe a way to talk about this issue is to frame the narrative as a question about freedom as opposed to a question about equality of treatment?
But this is a classic difference between liberals and conservatives as well, right? Conservatism isn't about equality, guaranteeing equality of outcomes. It's about equality of opportunity. And you asked a question about the Log Cabin Republicans, and I'm actually affiliated with a group called Go Proud, which is a gay conservative group. And they are completely They are conservatives first and foremost. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. So, but I think you can make there are strong conservative arguments for guaranteeing equality of opportunity, and that then extends to same sex.
But my point though on this is if part of the focus of this book is how do we talk to young people?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that are you suggesting? And I think this is an issue in San Francisco we care a lot about, obviously enough, as you do in New York.
Yeah.
Is the right way to talk to young people about this to frame the issue, as you said, about personal freedom and liberty,
yes.
Or is the right way to
yes.
Talk to about it, about equality, which is the way it has
been
framed?
I think personal freedom and liberty, and that
and
will also
why?
Work for independents.
Why for millennials?
Well, but first of all, okay, so this generation, they are individually, this is why I think the framing of American individualism works for them. They have been, I think when you grow up with the internet, They've grown up with the ability to individualize their experiences and their interactions in a way that no other generation has. I mean, think about their music choices. They don't have to buy albums. They have playlists that are individualized. The websites, the cache of websites that they go to, their Facebook page, everything is individualized to their own personal tastes. And so I think that freedom and choice and individualism, although an individualism that's grounded by a sense of belonging to something larger to them, while they're individually centered, they're still they're connected to others. So it's this paradox. That's why I think that individual freedom and equal opportunity, because they expect equality of opportunity, but they don't expect equality of outcomes.
Okay. That makes sense. I'd be interested to see if you follow up on that in Fox. We'll see when you're talking. We'll be watching.
I use freedom to marry.
Pardon me?
I use the language freedom to marry.
Have you found that it's caught on with the commentators who talk to you?
No. I think I'm the only commentator that advocates for this at Fox News.
Interesting. All right, let me shift gears if I could. We have a few minutes left, and I'm sorry I couldn't get to everybody's questions, but here's one that sort of situates us in the Republican Party today. Your perspective. I got a bunch of questions about John Boehner, so I'm going to synthesize. What do you make of John Boehner's performance at this point? And also, since we have a presidential race coming up in 2012, Bachman, McConnell, and others, Mitt Romney, where do you see the future of the Republican Party in the presidential race? So look at the House leadership today.
First
and where
and
do you
then
see
second.
The rest?
So, John Boehner is the Speaker of the House.
So
he's third in line for the presidency. He has created his the election of 87 representative. Nobody knows who John Boehner is. No, you're not alone. Most people, unless you're like me and politically active, don't know who the name of the Speaker of the House. Unless you're from San Francisco, in which case you've known who Nancy Pelosi was for some time, who preceded John Boehner. I think John Boehner has been excellent. I think John Boehner has done a remarkable job of trying to corral a very diverse spectrum of new Republicans in the House of Representatives. And I think he was vilified by the president for being orange for a very long time. I don't know if you guys heard many of those jokes. The president was talking about his skin tone because John Boehner had this unnatural tan for some time. I don't make that. That was again my conservative attempt to be humorous, which is maybe why we don't have a show like Jon Stewart. but I think John Boehner has been remarkable. I mean, he has basically a year ago we were talking about runaway spending and debts and deficits that the country couldn't afford, and we were going to go over a fiscal cliff. And now, for as much as the dissent is that, oh, government doesn't work and we're gridlocked and the Republicans are hijacking the government, I think the reality is we're 6 days and counting, we'll thwart we won't default on our debt. And the reason we're not going to default on our debt and not have a naked debt ceiling limit is because of these 87 Republicans who were elected to Congress and John Boehner's ability to corral them. Yes, it's been extraordinarily challenging, especially because, the unfortunate reality is there are some new members of Congress who genuinely don't believe that we need to raise the debt limit. And that is a challenge. That is a real challenge. I mean, you have some ideological purism here. Not a lot, but it's there. I was in Washington last week talking to a few members of Congress, and one of them said, no, it's there. I think Boehner's done a remarkable job, and I think he's gotten a rap, especially because the narrative has really turned against him in the last 2 weeks. He doesn't have the advantage of the bully pulpit of the presidency, and I think he's been excellent, my personal view. The field in 2012 is still wanting, and that's not me. I think that's not just the Republican. I mean, that's the Republican base. That's the Republican Party. I think everybody is hoping that it is still immature and it fleshes itself out. There are more people who will likely get in the race. Rick Perry, for one, and
Governor
the Republican
of Texas.
Field, the governor of Texas, and the Republican field has not shaped up yet. And I think that there is sincere hope. You know, my book is intended to come out just soon enough so that whoever it is that gets the nomination can use it as a roadmap for connecting to the next generation, and I hope that they will.
Time we have left? About 7 seconds. Real quick question at the end. John McCain, you mentioned Republican feminism, made a pitch for women voters by including Sarah Palin. Maybe a pitch to reach out to Hillary Clinton's disaffected voters. In retrospect, be honest, good choice or bad choice?
Not for millennials and also not politically. I mean, the numbers show that. The numbers show that it polarized independence, that Sarah Palin polarized independence. And what she's done since then, I mean, she shored up. John McCain will never regret that decision because, I mean, he even viscerally saw the crowds dynamically changed when she became part of the ticket.
But isn't she a rugged individualist?
Yeah, well, here's... In some ways, she is, actually. And I write about a new Republican feminism. I know we only have 7 seconds, so I'm going to go fast. I write about I have a whole chapter called A New Republican Feminism, which is trying to chart, I try to chart a new course for women in the Republican Party, that there doesn't have to be a litmus test for how women should be, that women can choose a variety of life's paths. And I think that Sarah Palin, while this does not appeal to millennials, it certainly appeals to me. I think it's remarkable that she's a mother of five and has been a governor of a state. She is very accomplished in her own right, and she's done enormous things since being on the ticket, but she does not appeal to millennials. And she, you know, she clearly, the polling shows us, shifted. While she shored up the Republican base, she did not help win over independents. And so I think at the end of the day, while John McCain would never regret that decision, I think it did make a difference in his ticket.
Okay. A very honest answer to a difficult question. Our thanks to Margaret Hoover, Fox News contributor, member of the Board of Overseers of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, that school that people go to when they don't go to Berkeley, and author of the new book, you should all go out and buy, American Individualism, How a New Generation of Conservatives Can Save the Republican Party. We also thank our audiences here live and on radio and television. I'm Joe Tooman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.